From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we start the hour with today's preliminary report on the Ethiopian Airlines crash last month that killed everyone on board. The crash involved a Boeing 737 MAX plane, and today investigators confirmed that a new stall prevention system involved in another crash, the Lion Air crash last year, was engaged in the Ethiopian crash. Ethiopia's transport minister also said today that during the brief flight, the pilots followed protocol.
The crew performed all the procedures repeatedly provided by the manufacturer, but was not able to control the aircraft.
Joining us now is Seth Kaplan here, and our transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And take us through these findings out today. First, the idea that the anti-stall system was engaged multiple times before the crash. Why is that important?
Yeah, the anti-stall system, Jeremy, was designed to prevent crashes, now suspected of causing both of these crashes. An airplane, when its nose pitches or sort of angles up, is in danger of stalling if the angle is too high. And engineers were concerned that this particular plane was at more risk of that than other planes, so they designed the system to automatically pitch the nose down. Here we have another crash now where a bad reading from one lone sensor apparently caused the system to think the nose was pitched up, even though it wasn't. So it pitched the nose down so much that you ended up having a crash as a result.
And what about the part of today's report that says that the pilots actually followed Boeing's protocol? Because Boeing knew that this was an issue. The pilots followed their protocol and the plane still crashed.
Yeah, it tells us that the protocol apparently wasn't enough. And that's significant because, yeah, up until now, there had sort of been this nuance that, well, at least if you sort of knew what to do, maybe you wouldn't have had a crash. The Lion Air crash, rather clearly, the pilots didn't know what exactly to do. But here you had pilots that, according at least to this preliminary release of the investigation, did know what to do, and it happened anyway. So that kind of weakens Boeing's standing, let's say, in terms of just the idea that the system could have worked at least under the best of circumstances.
What is Boeing saying about today's report?
Boeing is saying that it's reviewing the report. It hasn't disputed anything in there so far. Again, extended its sympathies and its commitment to get this right with the fixes that it wants to implement.
And what does it tell you that obviously the pilots knew about the anti-stall software and knew that there was a protocol to be followed? It suggests that the pilots were very much aware of what was going on.
It does. And that's what Ethiopian Airlines had said. So that's what was they were saying different about this crash from the first one. And what had changed in the 5 months since the first crash is that Boeing, which had been accused of not doing enough to make sure pilots knew how to override the system, got the information out there. Pilots, yeah, before there were at least some number of pilots around the world who just seemed not to know what to do. These pilots, we now know, according to this investigation, seemed to know what to do, and yet the crash happened anyway.
Now, Boeing, of course, would like to get these planes back in the air. The 737 MAXs have been grounded around the world. They're working on a fix to the software. And yesterday, Boeing agreed to a third-party review to look at the 737 MAX. How significant is that?
It's significant, and I think, Jeremy, ultimately helpful to Boeing. I mean, look, it's not going to move the process along any quicker, that's clear. But when you have somewhat of a credibility crisis, as Boeing has right now, as the FAA has right now, you want somebody on the outside to look at this and say, yes, this is indeed a fix that will prevent this from happening again. And by the way, the one good thing I would say, Jeremy, about what came out today is that at least we know that this crash was indeed related to the same kind of cause. I mean, the worst news of all could have been that just something entirely different caused this. So at least the fix that Boeing has and that the FAA is working on certifying addresses the same cause, even though those questions about the pilots' knowledge and abilities have kind of gone somewhat at least by the wayside.
How are the airlines going to convince people to get back on these planes? I imagine that as people watch the news and hear the news about these, they say to themselves, well, I'm not getting on one of those.
No question. I think that third-party review will help. But in the end, it's just going to be experience with these planes flying safely again for a period of time that's going to convince people. Those first flights, you're going to have nervous flyers. I mean, I personally would get on one kind of thinking, well, no plane has been scrutinized quite like this one, and it should be fine. But I think it's just going to take a matter of weeks, months before people just kind of move on and worry about something else, because you can't blame people for wanting to avoid these. And you've got flight searches out there helping people do that, allowing them to filter out the MAX.
And just real quick, do you think that the FAA is going to change how it certifies planes?
I think so. Anytime you have a major incident, series of incidents in this case like this, something changes. Even with the Dreamliner grounding a half decade ago, I mean, nobody died there, but it was a real rough entry into service for new aircraft. A lot of things changed. In that case, Boeing accused of outsourcing too much, brought a lot of it back in-house.
Right.
Now a whole other series of things that are going to have to change, and I think many of them will.
Seth Kaplan, Here Now Transportation Analyst, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, now a story that's also about trust and science and what happens when the public doesn't believe in a researcher's work. Devang Mehta is from India. He spent 4 years in Switzerland getting his PhD. His topic, helping farmers in developing countries grow genetically modified crops, what we usually call GMOs, that are resistant to disease. Devang was passionate about the humanitarian potential of GMOs, but ultimately decided to abandon the field. Liz Tung from member station WHYY reports.
Devang chose his PhD program in Zurich, Switzerland for a reason.
So the lab I joined is actually quite famous in the field of genetic engineering because the professor who was heading the lab just before I joined actually created a GMO called golden rice.
Golden rice is rice that's genetically engineered to contain vitamin A, and it represented the whole reason why Devang wanted to research GMOs. The professor he mentioned is Ingo Patricus, and he engineered golden rice as a way to fight childhood blindness caused by malnutrition. Devang was super excited to join the lab that landed this discovery. But the people he met in Switzerland, at parties, walking around, they didn't share his enthusiasm.
If the topic of my research came up, it would just be met by this really awkward silence, because especially among my generation in Europe, the field of, like, the label of GMOs has been completely demonized.
There was one incident in particular that stood out to Devang. He was attending a panel talk about GMOs. It was going well until a protester interrupted.
You know, she was talking about a friend of hers in the U.S. who had a child with autism, and she seemed to believe that the autism was caused due to the genetically modified corn that is grown in the U.S. and consumed by people living in the U.S.
Devang was stunned. Was this how people viewed his work, and by association, him? He became fixated on trying to explain to people GMO's potential for good, how projects like his genetically engineered cassava could help farmers in developing countries protect their crops from disease. And then inevitably, he'd get the same question. Why can't farmers just use safer insecticides or organic farming?
Switzerland is one of the richest countries by per capita income in the world. And so it was really hard to communicate to people over there that these are not options in countries like Kenya or India.
He says GMOs could be the difference between whether or not farmers are able to feed their families, or in the future, if countries are able to feed their people. So he took it personally when people labeled GMO researchers as,
you know, these kind of hyper-capitalist scientists who are bought by industry and support industry. But that's not who I am.
Devang says people have all these suspicions about scientists being on the payroll of big corporations, willing to poison the world for a buck. He says that's just not how science works. Still, he gets why some people are suspicious.
I think there are some legitimate reasons for why people have distrust of science. A lot of this goes back to kind of the way scientists defended big tobacco in the 60s or the use of science in warfare.
Wherever this mistrust was coming from, it was not good news for Devang's job prospects.
I quickly realized that a lot of researchers were quitting the field just because of, you know, it was difficult to get funding because of the public opposition. It was difficult to do experiments in Europe.
The straw that broke the camel's back came in the form of a paper written by Ingo Patricus, the golden rice inventor who inspired Devang to come to Zurich in the first place. Ingo's paper talked about his frustration with the fact that more than 10 years after announcing Golden Rice to the world, it still wasn't being distributed because of pushback from anti-GMO groups like Greenpeace.
I think that really brought home the message to me that this wasn't a field of research that I wanted to spend too much of my future life on, because it was just too difficult to deal with so many different problems while trying to build up a career in science.
By the time Davon graduated in 2017, he'd made his decision. He was leaving GMO research. He said it was hard leaving something that he'd invested so much time in.
But I'm also kind of relieved that I don't directly have to deal with the pushback anymore.
These days, he researches plant genetics at the University of Alberta, but he still speaks up for GMOs when he can. As a scientist, he thinks of it as an obligation. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Tung.
And her story came to us from The Pulse at WHYY. Fans of Sarah Bareilles, rejoice. Her new album, Amidst the Chaos, is out this week. You know, she's been a little busy, taking a couple of turns starring on Broadway as Jenna in Waitress, the Tony-nominated musical for which she wrote the music and lyrics.
She is messy, but she's kind. She is lonely most of the time. She is all of this mixed up and baked in a beautiful pie. She is gone, but she used to be mine.
Sarah Bareilles also starred as Mary Magdalene in last year's live televised version of Jesus Christ Superstar.
I don't know how to love him, what to do, how to move.
That's her with Josh Groban singing the opening song of the Tonys, which the pair wrote with Shana Tell.
This one's for the loser inside of you.
But now an album produced by T-Bone Burnett, 12 original songs, including this one, Armor, inspired by the Women's March of 2017.
Strength means blessed with an enemy. Oh,
that's Armor from Sarah Bareilles' new album, Amidst the Chaos, and she joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hi.
Why this album now? I'm detailing everything you've been doing. What's the thinking about, and I also have to do an album?
I think that, you know, wanting to make this record was deeply inspired by the election, to be honest, yeah, and getting to participate in the Women's March. And I really came away from those experiences reawakened and maybe awakened for the first time. And I think the incredible gift I got from the last 5 years of working on Waitress was this beautiful sense of how important collaboration is, and talking about themes that were sort of outside myself and my own story.
Well, and we hear it in some of the music. You have a couple of shout-outs to Barack and Michelle Obama, including If I Can't Have You. Let's just listen to a little of that.
Tell me that you're leaving. You say the time will slow the bleeding. Oh, this heart that I've placed into your hands, I held it out to you. Now you give it back. What am I supposed to do? Oh, I had a
This is the I Miss You Guys song. I think that I was so mournful to say goodbye.
Do you worry that you risk? You've sold millions of albums. You have fans across many spectrums.
Sure.
And do you worry that that might be offensive to them?
I think one of the personal evolutions that I've experienced over the last handful of years is a separation from that fear of disappointing people. I always come from a place of love and inclusion, and I don't want to apologize for my belief system. It feels more important to me to be honest than to sort of, you know, hope that someone buys my record.
Hmm. Well, and you also have several traditional songs, love songs on the album. I loved Someone Who Loves Me. Let's listen to a little.
St. Jude's wearing a smile. He wouldn't mind, I bet. I can't go face the world. My bones won't hold me up. So tell the saint of lost souls where to find me. Softly sleep.
That song in particular is really about my relationship to my own depression and anxiety and allowing someone else to sort of see you in your darkest hour. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I try to be outspoken about because I think it's easy to project a life that looks really sunny, but I'm someone who has to be really conscious about how I manage my own inner life.
Tell me more about that. I mean, is this something that you can put a name on or just a darkness?
I think melancholy has always been a really good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. I think I had my first sort of mini nervous breakdown when I was just in my early 20s and felt mm-hmm. like I was going crazy and was having some disassociation and couldn't stop hearing my thoughts. But I'm someone who's been in weekly therapy for years and years, and I'm a huge advocate. But I'm someone who just is going to have a relationship with it for the rest of my life. And I'm much better at managing it now than I have been in the past.
Well, between you and your many fans is this deep love, especially around the anthems. And I call them anthems that you've written. I'm thinking of that video that went viral, millions saw it, of young cancer patients dancing and singing to your song Brave.
But I wonder what would happen if you say what you want to say.
And then we know your song, She Used to Be Mine. Everyone has made videos of themselves singing this, including a ninth grader, Adrian Matthew, from Blairsville, Pennsylvania. Let's just listen to a little. I know when yoga teacher Tara plays your Once Upon Another Time during class, I have to be taken out on a stretcher.
Once upon another time, before I knew which life was mine, before I left the child behind me.
Songs that are these anthems, is that something that helps you get at that feeling, or do you worry sometimes that you'll get too close to such a deep feeling?
To the darkness.
Yeah, you know,
I think in my heart of hearts, I don't feel like there is such a thing as too close to the darkness. I think we can't be afraid of what is, and the closer we can go to what's just true, it sort of takes the bite out of it. If you can just be with whatever the feeling is and know that you don't have to change it or fix it, working on the practice of acceptance, I think, is a really, it's a huge theme for me in my music. It's certainly part of what I want to sort of preach in my own way to my fans, that like, we are all perfectly imperfect.
Jesse's doing backflips, Molly's doing so well.
Joey's got a new girl, Emily moved away. And the world's on fire the whole time, we're trying to put out the flame. If it gets louder now, can't stop it, won't slow down. Lost in this, all I can do is keep my eyes on you, I know the world.
That's Sarah Bareilles. Her new album is Amidst the Chaos. And by the way, you can see her as the musical guest on Saturday Night Live this coming weekend. Scared? Nervous? Excited?
All of the above. Yeah. I mean, this is a real bucket list moment for me. I SNL has been on my list since I was, you know, in my teens. So I turned 40 this year. So it's been a long walk.
You're going to crush it. Is there something that you'd recommend for the end of the segment?
I have to say, I think my favorite song on the record is a song called Saint Honesty.
Yeah.
And the reason I love it so much is because I've always been sort of too intimidated to put myself in the recording studio at the same time as all the session musicians. Mm. I have some real timidity as a piano player, and I worry about making mistakes. And one of the great gifts of working with T-Bone Burnett is that he's really not about perfection at all. He's all about capturing a moment. So he really encouraged me to make music with the band. And it's the first time I've ever done that in my whole career.
Wow.
As a recording artist. And I feel really proud of that. And there's mistakes and there's little imperfections, but it feels like the song's heart is intact. And that's the whole point of the whole record, is that mistakes and all, it's all welcome here.
Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Trump is set to meet with Chinese Vice Premier Liu He at the White House today, and that could be a sign that trade negotiations between the two countries are nearing final stages. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. He's been standing by, and Robin, I know, love and listening to Sarah Bareilles, but now we'll get to the matter at hand. How are you?
Everybody wants to hear about China and trade after Sarah Bareilles.
Exactly.
Right?
So that's where we'll go. We know that Liu He is Xi Jinping's number two. He's been meeting with top officials in Washington all week, trying to work out this deal. Is the fact that he's now sitting down with President Trump, big news that something could be coming?
I'm not necessarily sold on that. I mean, both sides here are intensely mindful of what they're telegraphing. Nobody wants to look like he is capitulating. And I say, look at this quote from China's foreign ministry because it speaks volumes. Quote, "We have noted that President Trump has repeatedly expressed his expectation to meet again with President Xi Jinping. President Xi Jinping also looks forward to maintaining communication with President Trump through various ways," close quote. I mean, talk about unrequited flirting.
Yeah, right. And we are hearing, though, that there have been big steps. The biggest component, China will buy more U.S. commodities, soybeans, energy products. But we're not hearing about these structural changes that the president was pushing for, everyone was pushing for, stopping the theft of intellectual property, ending Chinese state subsidies. So has this script now shifted?
More about kind of punting the script, if that's okay to mix those metaphors, Robin. I mean, under the leaked terms of the agreement that's being proposed, China would commit by 2025 to buy U.S. commodities, more U.S. commodities, and allow 100% foreign ownership for American companies operating in China as a binding pledge that can trigger retaliation if they don't fulfill this pledge. But then there are other non-binding promises that China has offered to implement by 2029, and they would not be tied to U.S. retaliation. So I see a lot of kind of watering down here.
Well, we did hear this week that China announced a ban on fentanyl. Now, it may be hard for the Chinese to stop the illicit production of this drug that kills so many in the U.S., but that was seen as a big victory for President Trump, sort of outside the negotiations, but affecting them.
Yeah, I mean, in negotiations, you're wondering what are the pain points for each side? And is it really painful for China to clamp down on fentanyl? I'm not so sure. Yeah. I mean, the deficit hit a massive level in 2018, and Trump is desperate for deliverables.
Yeah. What about tariffs? We're reading that the Trump administration's demanding that these punishing tariffs stay so that, you know, it can be used as leverage to get China to really make changes. But it's a big sticking point. China's position so far has been take them off or no deal.
Yeah, I mean, tariffs slapped on about $360 billion of each other's goods just in the past 9 months. And Trump is indicating that some of the tariffs have to stick around, in his words, for a substantial period of time to keep China honest and motivated. So I'm curious to see how much of that language remains firm and non-negotiable into the final deal that, if at all, emerges from this.
Yeah, just have a few seconds. So the Trump administration pushing this commodities angle, you know, this is also – there's politics here. And, you know, he can say going into 2020, look, I closed the trade deficit.
Yeah, it's all about deliverables for him to forge ahead into the Rust Belt and agricultural regions and actually have something to brandish. But then again, you know, if China's committing to 2025 and 2029, they could possibly be dealing with a new regime after Trump is gone. So many, many, many moving parts.
We don't call them regimes. But Robin, thank you. Robin Farzad, who hosts Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
New York will be the second state to enact a plastic bag ban after California. Lawmakers agreed to ban them in the Empire State next year. One of the big concerns about plastic bags is that they end up in the ocean and last for a really long time. They shouldn't be used for a 5-minute shopping trip. But our next guest says plastic bag bans have unintended consequences. Rebecca Taylor is an assistant professor with the School of Economics at the University of Sydney in Australia. She joins us on Skype. Rebecca, you started your research on this after having lived in cities in the U.S. that have implemented plastic bag bans. So what have you seen in terms of what happens when a city decides to either ban or tax plastic bags?
Right. So what we see is that one of the goals is to increase the use of reusable bags, and we do see that. When I looked at these policies, I found that about 50% of customers begin bringing reusable bags with them to the store. Another set of customers that don't bring reusable bags continue purchasing disposable bags, generally paper bags if plastic bags have been banned. So about 30 to 40% of customers begin purchasing paper bags, and the remaining do usually just don't bring a bag at all.
Mm-hmm. And are the paper bags generally better for the environment, would you say, than the plastic bags?
The paper bags have their own set of environmental concerns. They're more energy and water intensive to produce. They're heavier, so they take up more room in transportation. So generally, life cycle assessments, reports that look at the environmental consequences, rate paper bags as worse than plastic bags. However, these life cycle assessments don't do a great job of thinking about what happens if that plastic bag makes it into oceans and waterways where it can affect wildlife.
Well, and the other thing is the bags that you're talking about, the reusable bags that people can purchase at the supermarket, those may not be used over and over again hundreds of times. Maybe somebody uses them two or three times and then they either end up in a closet for a long time or they themselves end up in the ocean.
Yes, exactly. So with the thicker reusable bags, they have to be used a certain number of times to have the same environmental impact as the thin plastic bags. So for instance, a cotton bag would need to be used 131 times to have the same life cycle or to have the same global warming impact as a thin plastic bag. If you used your thin plastic bag as a garbage bag, gave it a second use, you would then need to use your cotton bag 327 times to have the same impact as that thin plastic bag. So we do need to see a lot of reuse of various types of reusable bags to bring that environmental impact equal with the plastic bags.
So I hope that all of our listeners with their public radio tote bags are taking note there that they're going to have to use them a lot in order to make it make sense for the environment. What about the idea that people actually are using garbage bags more often, you found, because of plastic bag bans?
Yeah. So one other thing I looked at, not just the types of bags customers use at checkout, also the kinds of bags that they're purchasing. And what I find is that when plastic grocery bags are banned, sales of garbage bags skyrocket. So in particular, small garbage bags, so the same size as a grocery bag, those go up by 120%. Hmm. So we're seeing big increases. When we convert this into total plastic, about 30% of the plastic that was eliminated by banning the thin plastic grocery bags comes back in the form of thicker trash bags.
So what's the solution then? If reusable bags have their issues, if paper bags have their issues, and obviously garbage bags are really no better than single-use plastic bags, what should people do?
My policy recommendation is to make the price of all types of bags transparent to customers. The big issue with traditional thin plastic grocery bags is that they seemed like they were free. They actually aren't free. You paid for them in your overall price of the groceries, but it seemed like you were getting them for free, and that led to a lot of overuse. So I generally support fees and taxes over complete bans because they allow for a bit more flexibility. You can still reuse your thin plastic bag. You just now have to pay for it, and you're taking on that cost, and so you're adding your own value to it.
What do you say to people who say, no, I'm one of the good ones. I use my single-use plastic bag to pick up after my dog, and so therefore I'm using it again. Is there anything good about that, or is that just postponing the inevitable, which is that that bag probably eventually ends up in the ocean?
No, I mean, I think it's great reusing any item, even items that were deemed as single use. If you're reusing them, they're not single use. You've made them, they're still disposable, but you've given them a second use. And if you're using it to pick up dog poop or to throw away diapers or, you know, any form of trash, that bag is much more likely to end up in the landfill instead of litter.
What do you use when you go to the grocery store?
I use a mix, to be honest. I use the disposable bag for my recycling, for using as garbage bags. I bring my own. I have a variety of reusable bags that I bring. So I don't necessarily think one size fits all for any trip, but the more you can reuse an item, the better it is generally for the environment.
That is Rebecca Taylor, who's an assistant professor with the School of Economics at the University of Sydney. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy, for having me.
And let us know what you do when it comes to bag use at hereandnow.org. Again, one of the big concerns about plastic bags is that they end up in the ocean. And here's an example of what happens. A pregnant whale was found dead last week in Italy with nearly 50 pounds of plastic in her stomach. Joining us now is Vicky Croak, who covers animals for us. Hi, Vicky.
Hey, Jeremy.
And first, tell us more about this whale in Italy. It's so sad.
The pregnant sperm whale in Sardinia was found with all kinds of plastic in her stomach, plastic bags, plastic plates, and fishing line, among other things. Much more trash than actual food items like squid, and making it all even more sad, she was carrying a dead fetus.
And do we know exactly how she died?
Not yet. A necropsy is being done to determine the exact cause of death. But considering the pounds of plastic bags, plates, fishing net, and more twisted up in her belly, scientists say it's obvious trash was at least a factor.
And this is not the first time that we've heard about a whale death like this, even just in recent months.
No, there have been many other examples. Just last month, it was a dead whale in the Philippines with nearly 90 pounds of plastic ingested. The images from these cases are shocking. Often we see pictures of the stomach contents, a heap of plastic with very identifiable items.
And these are just whales that we're talking about right now, but I imagine that the plastic in the ocean is affecting all kinds of other animals, seabirds, turtles, fish.
Right, hundreds of species. And turtles, for instance, may consume plastic bags, which can make them sick or kill them. It may interfere with their ability to dive. They might become tightly entangled in ocean refuse and lose flippers. Carl Safina, the writer, scientist, naturalist, happens to be a friend of mine, who's the founder of the Safina Center, has described seeing an albatross coughing up a toothbrush while she was trying to feed her chick. And there have been photos of dead chicks whose little bodies were full of plastic trash, including jar lids and lighters. But in the horrible news about the tons of plastic refuse in the oceans today, whales are the headliners. They're big and beautiful. And when they ingest plastic and it's tallied, the totals are enormous.
And of course, whales go into the deeper parts of the oceans, but we are also seeing plastic pollution in the shallower parts as well. Do researchers know how much plastic is out there?
Well, we have some estimates to go off of. A study reported in the journal Nature in 2015 is often cited. An estimated 8 million tons of plastic trash goes into the ocean every year, estimated. And some estimates say that 60% of seabird species have ingested plastic. And people even try to find out thresholds, like how many pieces of plastic a turtle can eat before health is affected.
So what are the ideas about trying to stop these animal deaths from happening? I mean, are we hearing about them more just because there's more reporting on them, or is it that they are actually happening more often?
Everyone says it's happening more often, but it's pretty sobering that we don't hear about a number of them. We can't even estimate how many of those are. But environmentalists, conservationists, they're looking for fast action, stepping up recycling, more biodegradable materials, less plastic, and for smart, widespread and innovative efforts at cleanup. We'll have to see what kind of support they can get for these efforts.
And Vicky, as somebody who cares for and loves animals so much, what do you do when it comes to plastic bags? Do you use plastic bags at the supermarket, or do you bring your own bags?
Bringing my own bags, trying as much as possible, as your previous guest was talking about, various ways we can use things again and again and get plastic as much out of our life.
That is Vicky Croak, who covers animals for us at Here and Now. Vicky, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And let's take a look now at the big brouhaha over school lunch and breakfast. Six states and the District of Columbia are suing the Trump administration over its reversal of nutritional standards that were implemented during the Obama administration and promoted by former First Lady Michelle Obama under her Let's Move campaign to fight childhood obesity. The lawsuits say the Agriculture Department weakened requirements that school lunches have more whole grains and less salt. NPR's Allison Aubrey has been following this. Hi, Allison.
Hi there, how are you?
Good. So start with, what were the rules and what was the goal?
Sure. Well, I mean, the standards really aim to make schools a whole bunch healthier. And compared to 10 years ago, I would say school meals are healthier. The new standards that were set back a few years ago reduce the amount of salt or sodium allowed in school meals, reducing it gradually over time. And that's what the big debate is right now. And another goal was to get away from all the white breads, the white pasta, the refined carbohydrates, and serve more nutrient-dense whole grains. Mm-hmm. So that's the path that schools have been on, but the changes that the Trump administration have made have slowed this down and given schools more flexibility in the eyes of the administration.
Well, and one of the things that was required, that if there was flavored milk, for instance, it'd be fat-free. But Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue was very clear early on that he wanted to change these guidelines. He said things kind of like, chocolate with fat, chocolate milk with fat made me big. And if kids, if kids are throwing the food in the trash, then they're not benefiting. We have heard that from others.
Well, yeah, there's been a whole lot of chatter about kids throwing away food because they don't like it. And, perhaps there was some of that when the guidelines first took effect. I would not be surprised by that at all as the mom of three children. Yeah. But I think that what the research shows is that one of the big things that can really undermine good nutrition in school is time. A recent study found that kids just feel rushed. It found that those who had less than 20 minutes to eat, which is a lot of kids, that they ate less of everything compared to kids who had more time to eat. Also, there have been a lot of efforts in school to try to compensate for what's going on. Schools have started these share tables so food doesn't get wasted. You can take uneaten fruits and vegetables home with you. So there are lots of ways that schools have figured out how to help meet these guidelines, but also sort of work with kids and help them be healthier on their own terms.
Well, New York's Attorney General Letitia James announced her lawsuit yesterday outside of a school in Brooklyn. She says this rollback of nutritional requirements is attacking the health and safety of our kids, but also that Congress mandated that science, not taste, be the way this works. So will Congress now interfere with the rollback?
That would be opening up. It's possible they could do that. It's very unlikely Congress would have to go back and rewrite the law. I mean, really what's being debated here is how quickly do schools have to move to meet these targets or these new targets. They're sort of phased in over time. Right now, they're sort of in phase two out of phase four. And what the administration has done is just really slowed this process down. That would be a really hard thing to get in there and legislate around. I guess it is possible. But just to this overall point that this is really about science, not taste. I mean, to that point, there is the sort of science linking high sodium diets to poor health is very, very clear. I mean, too much sodium in our diets can elevate blood pressure, which is increases the risk of heart disease. And as I've reported, you know, kids in the U.S. consume about 3,300 milligrams of sodium per day. That's a lot more than the 2,300 milligrams recommended by the dietary guidelines. And similarly with whole grains, there's this big improvement when you eat whole grains over refined carbs. They offer up a whole lot more nutrition and, importantly, add in a lot of fiber. So that's the science. The science is very clear.
Yeah, and other advocacy organizations say that the agriculture department has data as evidence to show that schools that were following these guidelines were progressing towards meeting goals. So what happens now? I mean, if the administration has taken away, rolled back these rules, does it follow that this will be reversed?
You know, no, I don't think that's going to happen at all. I mean, look, there's a lot of efforts around the country. As the whole country has become more interested in healthy eating, I would say this. I mean, you can look to efforts in school districts in Illinois and Maryland, places they have competitions. Kids come up with meal recommendations. The winners are then featured on the menus. That's now become sort of a standard thing in schools around the country. There's Chef Dan Giusti, the former chef of Noma in Copenhagen, one of the top restaurants in the world, left this whole gig of fancy food behind and started this company called Brigade to make healthy school meals. So he's up and running in New London, Connecticut, and in some other places. There's Chef Ann Cooper out in Colorado doing scratch cooking in Boulder. There's lots of innovation. I'd say the big picture is that the national weakening of the sodium and whole grain standards are not a good thing when it comes to nutrition. I mean, every nutrition advocate will tell you that. And it will slow down some schools, but there's a lot of innovation and a lot of energy around trying to get kids to eat healthier.
Well, and we should say that the School Nutritional Association, they represent school nutrition administrators across the country. They support the changes because they say fewer kids are eating lunch at school. So we'll keep an eye on this. Take it up at another time. NPR's Allison Aubrey, thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.